Hi, I'm Tommaso, PhD student at Graz University of Technology.
And I'm Daniel, also a PhD student at the Graz University of Technology.
Welcome to Bridge the Gap, the physics-oriented podcast,
in which we give insights into various research topics and the life of scientists.
And by the way, if you want to contact us, you can drop a line to our email address, bridgethegap@tugraz.at. Hey Daniel.
Hey Tommaso.
Question for you. Do you know what's the most disordered place in the universe?
Yes, in fact, I know precisely. It is your office desk, of course.
Oh, come on. Maybe the part of the desk we share. Yours, to be precise.
I agree to disagree.
Oh, seriously, your desk might be among the most entropic regions in the known universe.
Yes, yes, you can't deny reality, but you can't change the facts.
Anyways, today we will tackle the topic of biophysics. Among other things, we'll be talking about entropy. In particular, its tendency to always increase, contributing to the disorder of the universe from Daniel's desk down to the very small scales, where cells are hard at work to resist the rise of entropy. And with us, to discuss about biophysics, Professor Dawe Buntais from Graz University of Technology.
But before we dive into the topic, we asked our listeners what they know about biophysics, and that's what they had to say.
I think biophysics is the study of animated matter, and a possible field of application would be the human, or moreover, some processes on small scales within the human.
Biophysics would be the combination of biology and physics, I guess. And I think there would be many fields of application in medicine, for example, like the MRI or X-rays. But I think it would also have to do with like the bodily functions, like looking at the physics side of things, how they work.
I have no clue. Enlighten me.
In my opinion, biophysics is a borderline between biology, physics, and medicine. And a big application, I guess, it's in the field of biomedical engineering. How it is relevant for humanity? Well, I guess a lot of the technology we have around now, for example, MRI that applies electromagnetic fields for imaging and many other examples, can help in the detection of diseases or even early detection of some illnesses that can be then treated and to help us live a long and healthy life.
Biophysics is the study of biological systems with physics on the nanoscale or microscale, probably. And I think this is very difficult because biological systems are always very complex and not like in solid-state physics, nice and periodic, for example.
All right. So today with us we have Dawe Buntais, professor at Graz University of Technology. And Dawe, can you please introduce yourself, tell us about your background, field of expertise, stage is yours.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks a lot for inviting me here. And so I am a physicist by training, starting off in experimental physics and then switching to theoretical physics for my PhD. And I work in the field of soft condensed matter physics and biophysics.
What is biophysics actually? Because it sounds a bit like a mixture of physics, chemistry and biology sort of.
We're starting with one of the hardest questions of all, I guess. Because biophysics is a very wide-ranging field with people from many different backgrounds now working in what is now called biophysics. But when you look at it from a very simple point of view, it's indeed a mixture of physics and biology, basically studying the physics that governs the behavior of biological systems. And I mean, nowadays, that is considered an interdisciplinary field. That's really at the edge of physics and biology. But for a long time in the past, these fields of physics and biology have been much more intertwined. Yes, in the 18th century, in fact, there's Galvani and Volta studying electricity, using actually the nerve of a frog's leg to build an instrument to measure electricity. Yeah, and this has been something that's been going on for centuries, that these fields have really, really interacted, have really been in close contact with each other. So when you consider a mixture of physics and biology, there's immediately a question of how do you do that? And the main issue there, I guess, is that biology is a very diverse field. It's essentially defined by the topic that it studies, so all living systems, but the methods and the type of questions that are being asked are very wide-ranging, and there are many different things from really molecular biology all the way to people studying population dynamics in groups of animals, for example. Whereas physics, on the other hand, is much more defined by a way of thinking. It's a method that we apply, whereas what it's being applied to is very variable. There are people studying galaxies and there are people studying atoms, and we're all doing physics in very much the same way. So that is also what in biophysics is very clear, I guess. It's applying the methods of physics onto the biological topics.
What is the most important focus of biophysics? For example, what kind of interactions are we talking about in here?
Yeah, so this is one of the primary questions. I think that's still an open question of what are the sort of questions that we need to ask to understand biology in more detail. And I think for a physicist, what we typically try to do is to find these sort of unifying principles. You have to get, ideally, you end up with a theory that fits on the back of an envelope and it describes, you know, most of what you can observe. But this is, of course, for biological systems, this is obviously a complicated endeavor. Yeah, for example, if you think about, you know, a single cell, some of these cells will develop into an earthworm and another cell will develop into an elephant. Whereas the cells themselves are very similar, right? So what is actually driving this enormous diversity? And it seems hard to find a theory that would actually capture this sort of wide-ranging phenomena. But there are aspects of biology where the idea of a unifying principle is much more feasible. In particular, that is the field of molecular biology. Yes, if you look at the molecules that actually govern the behavior of many of these cells, then the molecular processes are very similar. Yes, so the process by which, let's say, a cockroach sends a signal to wiggle one of its little legs is very similar to the process by which humans do the same thing. Even though a cockroach is much smaller and it's an invertebrate and it has an exoskeleton, so it's a very different type of animal. But the molecular processes are strikingly similar. Yeah, so molecular biology and by extension, molecular biophysics is really one of these fields where I think we can search feasibly for a physical theory that would describe these things in detail.
So what is the part of physics in molecular biology?
So physicists have always been very closely involved with molecular biology. One of the prominent examples of that is Erwin Schrödinger, who in 1944, he gave a series of public lectures at the University of Cambridge and wrote a little booklet afterwards called What is Life?, where he really discusses the thermodynamics of life. So how do you describe a living system based on the laws of thermodynamics? And he actually predicted also the molecular basis, particularly of the genetic mechanism. And he predicted that the genetic information must be contained on a single molecule, for example, years before the discovery of DNA. So that is very much an enterprise that physicists have always been involved in. And more recently, physicists have made very large contributions to the study of single molecules, for example, using single molecule experiments, and also in the field of computational modeling and theoretically modeling these molecular systems.
For liquids, say, one can roughly distinguish between polar and nonpolar ones, right? Can you tell us a bit what does it mean, polar and nonpolar, and also why they cannot be mixed?
Yes. So then, so here we get to how would we model such a molecular system? And then it's indeed the first question for a physicist, but to a large extent, how do we simplify? Because we'd like to have a system that is as simple as possible, still capturing the main features of the systems that we're interested in. And then if you look at a biological system, this consists to a large extent of water. That is typically around 70% or so of the mass. And then there are oily substances, so parts of the proteins, parts of the lipids that are that resemble oil molecules to a large extent. And then there are mixtures of these, so the so-called amphiphiles, so molecules that are part oily and part hydrophilic, as we call that. Yeah, so hydrophilic means that the substance loves water, so it really likes to be solvated in water, and hydrophobic is the opposite. It really doesn't like the water. Yeah, so if you look at one of these simplest systems, yeah, so a mixture of water and oil, then you can see that the oil is very hydrophobic. That means it doesn't like to be close to the water. And if you look at that in a very simple way, then essentially what the oil will try to create is a little bit of a distance between itself and the water. And if you have many different oil droplets, that means there's a lot of of space that's essentially excluded. There's no room for water or oil to be in that space. If, however, you put all these oil droplets together, then the overall excluded volume is reduced. Yeah, and that is a system that would, as a physicist would say, it maximizes the entropy. So it maximizes the different ways in which the system can organize itself. So that is the preferred state that the system goes to. So then you have a separation of oil and water. Now, if you have these amphiphilic molecules, so molecules that are part hydrophobic and part hydrophilic, then, of course, the hydrophobic part would like to stick together. So you get one connected area of hydrophobic parts of the molecule, and the hydrophilic parts will do the same. Yeah, so this leads to a system that, just by maximizing the entropy, will self-assemble into different types of structures. And this is precisely what you see. So one of the most prominent molecules that are amphiphilic in biology are what we call lipids. So lipids have a hydrophilic head group and then a long a sort of carbon-like tail, and they form these lipid membranes. So they stick all their tails together, and the head groups are the hydrophilic head groups are solvated in the water. And this is what forms the membranes of biological cells, and it forms lots of the internal structure of a cell.
How does soap, for example, enter this picture?
So soap is indeed one of these amphiphilic molecules, and it does precisely the same type of thing. If you have an oily substance that you'd like to get rid of and wash away, then you use soap in order to dissolve your oily substance in the tails of the soap, and then use water to dissolve the entire structure of oil and soap together and wash it out. So that's very much the same type of mechanism. And in fact, with soap, you can make also these sort of bubbles that consist of sort of bilayer-like structures.
You mentioned before that lipids are also important for cells. Can you tell us why that is?
Yeah, so a cell, essentially, the essence of a cell is that it's a compartment containing all the important molecules for the biological function of the cell. And it needs to be separated from its environment. And the lipids form the membranes that actually take care of that separation. And that separation is particularly important for regulating, for example, the transport of ions, of nutrients, of larger biomolecules into the cell and out of the cell. That is all regulated by the organization of the membrane and the way that, for example, protein pores are embedded in this membrane. And that is very much dictated by the nature of the lipids in these systems.
Can you tell us what is a protein? And if I'm not mistaken, in proteins, function is equal structure. So,
okay, so proteins are really, so it's the machinery of a living cell. Yeah, so these are the molecules that perform many of the vital functions of a cell. And they are formed according to this central dogma of biology. You start with a gene, with the DNA, which is then copied into a messenger RNA. The messenger RNA dictates the shape of a peptide sequence. And then when you have this peptide sequence, a polypeptide that is floating about in solution, then this peptide will fold into a functional protein. And the idea is indeed that the form of that protein dictates how it functions, that these two things are very closely related. Now, the folding process itself has, again, so there are many, many different influences that, or many different aspects that influence the precise folding of a protein. But one of them is, are these hydrophobic interactions. Yeah, part of the peptide sequence will be more hydrophobic than other parts, and that will, to a large extent, dictate how the protein folds.
So since you talked about folding of proteins, what about, can misfolding, if we can call it like this, happen? And what in that case?
Yes, so that's a very good question for proteins, because we know that there are many diseases that are actually caused precisely by misfolded proteins or proteins that are somehow faulty. And this misfolding can be caused by many different effects. So you can have misfolding simply because of the environment of the protein, the polypeptide sequence, let's say, while it was folding, was the wrong type of environment to fold into the right protein. But occasionally you also have faults in the polypeptide sequence. And so when the original mRNA that dictates the polypeptide sequence has a faulty sequence, let's say, then you get a polypeptide sequence that is wrong. And some of these polypeptide sequences we know about, So one of these faults that is prevalent in biology is a repeat of one specific amino acid. So it's what we call a poly-Q repeat that gives rise to a protein that doesn't fold properly, but instead many of these proteins stick together, forming a plaque. And these plaques are known to be causing diseases like Alzheimer's, for example. And so they really disturb proper functioning of a brain. And we know that that must be related to these misfolded proteins. And it's one of the aspects that biophysicists look into, because it seems very feasible to understand what exactly are the physical interactions that lead to this aggregation of proteins, and how is that related to the exact nature of these poly-Q sequences in a way that doesn't happen with other protein sequences.
So you mentioned this is basically the study of thermodynamics of life. And one important concept in thermodynamics is equilibrium. So what is the role played by equilibrium for a cell? Can a cell be in equilibrium? Can cells as a global unit, can they be in equilibrium? And can you describe the process?
Yeah, so that's a very good question. Because so far, of course, what we've been discussing is to a large extent soft matter, soap, oil, water. So what is it that makes the systems alive? And I guess we first need to ask, what do we mean by a system that is alive? It's typically a system that is moving, that is going somewhere purposefully, and in particular that's going much longer than you would normally expect for these systems. Let's say you take a simple pendulum and you give it a good swing. Pendulum will be going back and forth for a while, but after some time, its initial energy will be transformed to heat, and the pendulum will be stationary in perfect equilibrium. And that, for us, means the system is not alive, right? It's clearly a system that's not living. Now, from a physicist's point of view, what the pendulum is doing is it's increasing its entropy all the time. Yeah, so it's going to the state of maximum entropy, which is the thermodynamic equilibrium. So that's the point where nothing changes anymore. And I guess the key point of a living system is that it manages to postpone that moment of thermodynamic equilibrium much further into the future than you would normally expect. Yeah, so it's somehow able to reduce its production of entropy, yeah, or to compensate for it. Yeah, so the question is, how does a cell, yeah, a biological cell, how does it actually do that? How does it reduce this entropy production? So basically what it needs to do to reduce the entropy is to create order. Yeah, creating more order will decrease the entropy and it will keep the system away from this state of maximum entropy. So it needs to do that by, for example, taking up ordered matter in the form of nutrients or more complex molecules that are very ordered typically. Or in the case of many plant cells, it does so by taking up sunlight and using that sunlight to synthesize more complex molecules.
So to say out of equilibrium, it needs, as you described, sort of some energy source, right? In terms of longer molecules, yeah? But how does it exactly convert it to energy then? Like, how is this turned into something that the cell can use in some way?
Yeah, and the cell harnesses this the energy that's coming in from the sunlight using a number of molecules that are in the cell membrane that essentially catalyze the reaction in a way that you can create these more complex molecules.
So one can say that equilibrium means death for living beings, right?
Exactly, exactly. That is certainly the case. So once the cell is in equilibrium, it's dead.
So now you gave us a bit of an overview of the basics, I would say, of some basics in biophysics. Can you tell us a bit more maybe about your research that you do?
Yes. So I've been interested for a long time in a specific topic of electrostatics in these complex systems. So electrostatics, if you simply look at a couple of charges, it seems relatively straightforward. You have positive charges, for example, repelling each other, but if you have a positive and a negative charge, they attract. But if you look at a molecule, you can have not only integer charges, but you can also have a distortion of the charge distribution, which would generate first a dipole and then also higher order multipoles. And if you have these dipoles, they also interact with each other. And especially if you put many of them, there are correlations between the dipoles, and that creates a whole environment in which these electrostatic interactions are not as straightforward as you would expect that they are. And an important consequence of that in biology comes from the fact that biology is, to a large extent, it's all solvated in water. Yeah, so water is all around. And the water itself is a very asymmetric molecule. So it has two hydrogens on one side of an oxygen and no hydrogens on the other side. So that creates a very large imbalance in this internal charge distribution. So there's a very large permanent dipole. And then on top of that, it can also have an induced dipole. So a dipole that is created when an electric field is applied. And if you have many of these molecules together, they really affect the interactions between other charged objects within that environment. So if you now take some macromolecule, a biological molecule, it's typically charged due to protonation and deprotonations of chemical groups on its surface, then there is an electrostatic interactions between these charged objects that is very strongly affected by the water in between. And then on top of that, within the biological cell, the environment is really rather crowded. Yeah, the cell is only around a micrometer size and it's full of different molecules and pieces of membrane and pieces of other bits and pieces of the biological machinery. So it's very clear that that I'm a physicist. I just look at these things as objects floating around. Yeah, so in terms of biology, I'm a bit of a dilettante, but I think that's typical, I guess, for physicists working in this field. In any case, so we have charged objects floating in solution. And then what we're interested in is how do these things interact? Do they coagulate? Are they stable in solution? Or are there any specific interactions with specific types of molecules like to interact with specific other molecules? So this is, in order to study this properly, we really need to know the exact interactions of the water molecules, the structure of the water around these objects, and then on top of that, all the other charged particles in this system, in particular ions in the system, that affect the interaction as well. It can be, for example, adsorbed to a surface, changing its effective charge, or they can be floating in solution, screening an electrostatic interaction further. So these are systems that are very varied, very much, there's a very strong dependence on the details, the molecular details of the system, on their macroscopic behavior. And it's something where, as a physicist, you can really work with electrostatics and with the thermodynamics and statistical physics of these that describe these systems accurately.
Can you give us a specific example to which you applied this? Some, I don't know, proteins or something where you use these techniques?
Yes. So very recently, in fact, we've been working on these type of proteins that I discussed earlier. These poly Q protein sequences, peptide sequences. And here, of course, again, within the protein, this is a very complicated system. It has a complicated geometry, and there's some variability into sequence length and heterogeneity of the sequence. Now, when we're looking at this as a physicist, we try to simplify again. So now we take a homogeneous sheet of the same type of amino acids that mimic these poly-Q sequences. And then we can actually calculate the direct interaction, first between the water and these amino acids, then between the ions that are in solution. And then from there, we can slowly build it up and actually get the interaction between two of these sequences, essentially mimicking the effect of two proteins that can stick together or stay in solution, solvated. And the question that we have there is really, what is the effect of the water in these systems? What's the effect of the charges on the surface? And what's the effect of the ions and the ion type in solution? So we study that using this mixture of techniques. We can do numerical simulations of ions in solution to really get the very complex interactions between many water molecules, the whole surface, and ions in solution. And then we can take some of the results from there and incorporate it into a larger scale theory that tells us what, for example, the pressure between two of these surfaces would be.
My curiosity is, are these techniques based on classical physics, right? You mentioned electrostatics. There's no effect at the quantum level, right? And so also as a follow-up question, maybe, to which extent can you follow the evolution of a given element in the system that you model? So also, what is the maximum number of objects you can trace, really?
Yes, so there we get to the sort of the computational details of a system. So to answer your first question on the quantum mechanics, we're sort of on the edge of where we can treat our systems classically and where quantum effects are important. So when you look at the distribution of charges within the molecules, this is clearly a this is a system that is where quantum mechanics is very important. So that is something that we have to either approximate or treat on the quantum level. But then when you go up and you treat an entire heavy atom, for example, and you say, you know, where's it moving under the influence of a certain force? This is definitely in the classical regime. So this is something that we can really model using classical molecular dynamic simulations, for example. But for the parameters that we set in order to set up a classical interaction potential, for example, we occasionally need also to study the quantum mechanical basis of these molecules. So as to the second part of your question, so the number of elements that we can study depends obviously on the computational resources that we have, but it's always way too small to simulate an actual, even a large protein is a challenge on that level. So what we do is we use these multi-scale techniques where we simulate a small part of the system and then use that information to put it onto more coarse-grained scale and then eventually incorporate it into, for example, macroscopic statistical physics in order to be able to say something about a much larger system.
Before you said that you can simulate sort of how two proteins interact with each other, and now you said also that you have to maybe coarse-grain some parts there. Can you then simulate the folding process of a protein itself?
Well, that's an excellent question. This is something that people have been trying for decades to do properly. Most proteins are a bit too large to simulate on the atomistic scale. But people have been using many different techniques of getting the folded structure out of a peptide sequence. And that has been, so there have been some successes there. But in the end, I guess it turns out to have an accurate prediction of the folded structure. There are so many parameters that actually affect the folding process that this is a little bit hard to deal with on using, for example, molecular simulation. Now, a very recent development is to use AI to do so, right? This is the AlphaFold program, for example, that just uses the information that we have from crystallized proteins, so experimental data, and then predicts the structure just based on the data that we have. And so that's basically fitting, using millions of parameters, fitting the process. And that works exceptionally well.
For arbitrary large peptide chains?
For many of the peptide chains that we know to fold into functional proteins, so the proteins where the peptide sequences are known, this works very well.
Instead, I'd like to know about your daily challenges in your field of expertise. For example, like, I don't know, what is the thing you like the most, the thing you tried to tackle and didn't work, the things that you normally do?
So when it comes to the things you try and that don't work, this is indeed very much part of my daily life. So there are many different things in a field that is essentially so open. Yeah, we don't really know which questions to ask. We don't really know which systems we will be able to describe properly. So in such an open field, of course, it's always the case that you try things and they turn out to be significantly more complex than you ever imagined. So this is very much a daily, I wouldn't call it a struggle. It's a challenge to pick the systems that we can work on and to try to ask the right questions there, questions that you can actually solve with this combination of physical tools that we have.
What's instead the result you're most proud about?
So one of the problems that we've been working on recently is the question of how does a membrane actually get its shape? And this is a project that we've been working on together with experimental physicists at the KFU, the group of Georg Papst in particular. And the idea is that if you look at the individual lipids that make up a biological membrane, then every lipid has an individual shape. Yes, some are some have a slightly smaller head group and slightly wider tails. Some have slightly smaller tails and a wider head group. And this diversity of the lipid shape turns out to be very important for the different type of structures that these lipids actually form. And they're very important, for example, for cell division. When you take an entire cell membrane and it has to somehow be pinched in the middle, in a way that it gets in the middle, it gets smaller and smaller and smaller. And then at some point, this one cell splits into two. Now, in order to do that, of course, the lipids right at the point where it's dividing, they need to somehow accommodate or even create this very strong bending. Now, in order to do that, you need different lipid shapes, different lipid types in there. So one of the questions that we've been that have been around for a long time is how do these lipid shapes, how do they actually affect the lipid, the morphology of these lipid membranes? And this is something that we've been studying in a combination of X-ray experiments, so to really get the molecular structure of lipid aggregates, and at the same time, computational physics. So we do molecular dynamic simulations of systems containing all these lipids, and we can really simulate how the lipids interact and what type of structures they actually form. And specifically, one of the things we've been doing is we've created a type of system that has been created in the group of Georg Pabst that is what's called an inverted hexagonal face. So these are lipids that are very strongly curved. So they have a very wide tail and a very small head group in a way that they like to sit in a very tight cylinder. So this is a very nice system to do X-ray spectroscopy on because you get the lattice constant of your cylinder arrays to very high accuracy. But now if you put in slightly different lipids that have a slightly different curvature, the lattice spacing will change a little bit. And it's precisely this change that will tell you what the shape of the individual lipids is. And this is something that we've been able to simulate. It's something that we've been able to put into the molecular model that we're using. And we really get very accurate results for the individual curvature of lipids and also of different mixtures of lipids. And this is a project that's very much ongoing. We're working on this. And there's still many really different things that we can do here. And it will really give us an insight into what type of systems are being formed by which type of lipids and lipid mixtures.
That sounds amazing. Especially your enthusiasm.
So what would you say are the most exciting recent developments in your field? And are there some things that you think will be possible in the near future?
So that's a very good question, because there are really many different things going on in biophysics, many different directions that people take. What I'm personally very excited about are things both in experimental physics, where people have been doing more and more single molecule experiments. So these are experiments really on looking at a single, for example, a molecular motor and seeing it spinning in real life, for example. Yeah, or isolating a single protein pore and recording the transport of molecules through that pore in real time. So these experiments, I think, are very exciting and give us a lot of information about what precisely is going on the molecular scale in these biological systems. In computational and theoretical biophysics, I think we're getting a much better grasp of how to treat these very complex systems. And that is, to a large extent, due to developments in computational physics. So we can now study systems really starting at the quantum mechanical level. So we can do a combination of DFT and molecular mechanics to study of the order of a few hundred atoms for a few nanoseconds. And then we can continue with classical mechanics, molecular dynamic simulations. We can continue to of the order of a million atoms, of the order of hundreds of microseconds. And then we can continue even further, do this, coarse grain it. And eventually we can use all that information to use the proper statistical mechanics. We really now, we know how to do that properly and use the statistical mechanics to get the properties of these biological systems to a very high accuracy, including all this molecular information, and then getting out the macroscopic properties of these systems to a very high detail. And I think that's a very exciting development that we can do that we can combine these computational methods with the known laws of physics and say something about systems that are so immensely complex that they have so far really defied a proper theoretical description.
So I guess this would then also be quite useful for development of new pharmaceutical products, no?
Exactly. So the applications of this type of science are very wide-ranging. And one of the most important ones is indeed in medical science. When we understand the molecular basis of many diseases, and we know for many diseases, we know roughly what the molecular problem is, then this type of theory and this type of science can do a lot to develop therapeutics and treatments.
Well, that was really an amazing discussion, Dawe. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening.
And hear you next time.
Ah, and by the way,
if you want to contact us, just send a mail to bridgethegap@tugraz.at.